This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Next week, the Democratic Party begins the process of choosing a presidential candidate and the philosophy it will take into the campaign against incumbent President George W. Bush next fall. Will the Democratic standard bearer embrace the center or energize the left? What does it mean to be a Big D Democrat? The answer to that last question has changed a great deal through the 200-year history of a party that started as an agrarian opposition to East Coast aristocracy. The party splintered over slavery, recast itself during the desperate days of the Depression, and evolved again in the 1960s over the issues of civil rights and Vietnam. Is there an intellectual or philosophical thread that defines the world's oldest political party, from Thomas Jefferson to FDR to William Jefferson Clinton? What people and events have transformed the Democratic Party, and how has it shaped America? Our focus is on history, so we'll get to the situation today towards the end of the discussion. If you'd like to join in, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Later in the program, we'll take a closer look at the little understood rules that could decide the winner of next week's caucuses in Iowa, and we'll find out how the candidates' futures market sees the race. But first, the second in our two-part series on the history of the major political parties. Tuesday, we spoke with Lewis Gould about the Grand Old Party, a history of the Republicans. Today, journalist Jules Witkover joins us from the studios of member station WOI in Ames, Iowa, to talk about the Party of the People, a history of the Democrats. Both volumes, by the way, are published by Random House. And Jules Witkover, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
The Democratic Party is almost as old as the country itself. Its birth can be linked to the rivalry of two men, Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. Tell us about what they represented.
Well, Alexander Hamilton was the founder of the first American party, the Federalist Party, which believed in supporting big business, a large federal establishment, and more concerned with commercial and banking interests. The opposition originally was not a party, but something just simply called the Anti-Federalists. But as the Federalists took control of the federal establishment, Thomas Jefferson, who was sympathetic to the Anti-Federalists but not part of them, decided that that another party needed to be created. And in a letter to George Washington, the President Washington, in 1792. Made a first reference to this party, which he called, interestingly, the Republican Party.
Confusing school children ever since.
Ever since, and not only school children. In any event, eventually the party, as it became more entrenched, changed its name to first the Democratic-Republican Party, and then eventually the Republican Party during the Jackson years.
Now, what values, what ideals did it embrace in those days?
Well, it really was a mirror image of the Federalists. It's particularly under the leadership of Jefferson, believed in interests of in farming and other rural interests. It was a party more of the frontier of the young country. As opposed to the northern cities that really were the bulwark of the Federalist Party.
Now, many of the founding fathers, and indeed President Washington himself, considered political parties a danger to democracy. In his farewell speech, George Washington said parties, quote, enfeeble the public administration and occasionally foment riot and insurrection. How then was our form of government so predisposed to political parties?
Well, actually, it was an outgrowth of the fact that the country itself at the beginning was quite unified against the evil of the time, which was the British monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the early days and years of the new country, it was focused more on that, and it was united against the British monarchy. And it continued even after the establishment of the country. But it was only then when the country was in its early years that the factions developed. Interesting that to me that Jefferson himself was against parties. He once said, "If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go at all."
Well,
of course, course, later he changed his mind, and Arthur Schlesinger observed later that Jefferson said that if he would not go to heaven with a party, he wouldn't mind going to the White House with one.
Well, it's interesting that these alleged nonpartisans, and Washington, beneath the surface, I guess, was a pretty dedicated Federalist, but these alleged nonpartisans, by the time of Jefferson's election, this was one of the most bitterly partisan elections in American history.
Well, there was a deep animosity grew between Alexander Hamilton, the head of the Federalist Party, the founder of the Federalist Party, and Jefferson. Not only on ideological grounds, but personally, they had Hamilton always tried to mess in the business of Jefferson when Jefferson was Secretary of State, and there were a number of other occasions when they were at loggerheads. And I don't know whether that was in Jefferson's mind when he decided that another party had to be created, but I would guess it was.
Our phone number, by the way, if you'd like to join our discussion about the history of the Democratic Party, which presidents do you think shaped it the most? Which policies emphasized the distinction of one person as a Democrat? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And it's interesting that, the Democrats, people always say that in a new democracy, it's not even the first election that's important or the second, it's the transfer of power from one party to another. If you can manage that, then maybe you've got a chance. And obviously with the United States of America, that was handled with the election of Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, Jefferson had been before that the vice president under the Federalist John Adams. It created a very awkward situation because under those at that time the Constitution stipulated that in an election the one with the most votes would become president and the runner-up would become vice president, and it so happened some various machinations on both sides that in 1796 the election was won by a Federalist. And a vice president was a Republican.
Let's get some callers involved. And Andrew joins us on the line. He's in Hamilton, New York.
Yes, I know Mr. Whitcover is aware of this, but I thought it was an interesting anecdote to bring up that the Democratic Republican Party really began with what was ostensibly called a botanical expedition. That Jefferson and Madison launched to visit upstate New York, supposedly to see the flora and fauna in the remoter regions of that state. But they were actually also visiting Aaron Burr and George Clinton to start a kind of coalition against the Hamiltonians. And this begins this unholy alliance begins what we now often refer to as the New Deal Coalition. Northern urban interests and southern agrarian interests and western interests against the entrenched elite in the eastern cities.
Yes, but the relationship with Jefferson and Aaron Burr did not turn out to be a very happy one, and that's another story.
That's another long story indeed.
That's certainly true, but it's interesting that I would be very surprised to see anybody on a political maneuver today launch a political maneuver by saying they were going on a scientific expedition. We would be so lucky as to have such avid naturalists among our candidates today.
Andrew, thanks very much.
We have a president who was talking about sending people to the moon. That certainly has political ramifications.
Certainly true. I wonder if he'll find allies there.
Okay. Andrew, of course, referred to George Clinton and the Clintons, a political dynasty in the state of New York in those early years. And interesting, you could talk about from Clinton to Clinton.
Well, you could, but there's really no connection.
none whatsoever. Once that coalition that we were just talking about, though, was forged, once Jefferson was elected, the Democratic Party was extraordinarily successful. It controlled the White House for the next 40 years. Why did it work so well?
Well, partly it was Jefferson himself who was a very innovative president and acquired the Louisiana Purchase, which was a key element in the development of the West, obviously. But also, there was a disintegration of the Federalist Party. Hamilton invited great criticism from the new party because of his affinity with the British, as Jefferson, on the other hand, had an affinity for the French. And for quite a while, the two parties were unofficially referred to as the Republican Party, which is now the Democratic Party, as the French Party, and the Federalist Party as the English Party.
A few Republicans today might describe the Democrats as the French Party.
Yes, I think they would.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Mike, and Mike is with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes. First of all, I was wanting to say that Andrew Jackson had a part in Democratic policy. I have two presidents here. Andrew Jackson had a part in Democratic policy because what he did as a Southern Democrat played into what Southern white males are doing in the Republican Party right now. And also Harry S. Truman, when he integrated the armed forces in 1948, forced those Southern white Democrats like Orville Faubus and Strom Thurmond to later follow George Wallace and Ronald Reagan's Christian coalition policy and become Republicans. That's basically the two Democrats that I think have play. The other reason I'm interested in this comment today is because Andrew Jackson tried to move some of my ancestors. I'm Choctaw and Cherokee.
Well, Jackson really was credited for making the Democratic Party a populist party. He opened up the White House, actually physically, but also he helped establish the Democratic Party, the identity he hopes to have now as the party of the little people. As far as Truman is concerned, I think Truman's late popularity and the credit he's received as an outstanding president derived from a great deal more than the integration of the armed forces, which of course was very important.
But race is an issue that runs through the travails of the Democratic Party almost from the very beginning.
Yes, of course, and it really came very close to destroying the Democratic Party through the secession of the South, the Southern states into the Confederacy, and the Civil War. It was interesting in looking back at this history to observe that the Democratic Party was really split into two parties after the advent of the Civil War. Those who remained in the party, but were not part of the war effort, were known as peace Democrats. Many from the South, but some from the North. Most of the Northern Democrats accepted the invitation of President Lincoln to join what he called the National Union Party. He changed the name of the Young Republican Party during the Civil War and invited many of these Democrats in, and many did join. But after the war, the peace Democrats took great criticism, some very sharp criticism, as being the party of treason for not having joined the new National Union Party, which returned to being the Republican Party after the war.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
No problem.
We're talking about the long and often surprising history of the Democratic Party. If you have questions about the Party of the People, its evolution and its influences and its influence on shaping America, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're tracing the history of the Democratic Party with Jules Witkover, author of Party of the People from Random House. He's with us from the studios of member station WOI in Ames, Iowa. You're, of course, invited to join the discussion. What do you think are the major milestones for the party? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address, totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. Susan's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. As you said, the Democratic Party started out as the Anti-Federalists, That was originally a states' rights, anti-big government type of party, whereas today it's known as the party of big government, and I was wondering when that shift came about.
Well, it really evolved after the Civil War, as I indicated earlier. The Democratic Party was in a shambles and went through a long period of almost 50 years after the Civil War without having elected only one Democratic president. It began to evolve to its identity today, even before the New Deal, when you had populists such as William Jennings Bryan, who labored diligently but unsuccessfully for the presidency, but did help to give the party even more of a populist identification than it had received under the Jackson years.
But he famously ran three times and succeeded none.
That's right. And I don't know, he himself changed a great deal during that time and had a very sad ending when, after his political career, which included being Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, died in the days after the famous donkey trial in over evolution in Tennessee. The monkey trial, excuse me.
Yes. Donkey's another part of the Democratic Party. Susan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk with James, and James is with us from St. Paul.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Sure.
My question involves the relationship of the Democratic Party to questions of race, particularly to African Americans, because it's my long-held impression that the Democratic Party was founded in large measure by very powerful slaveholders and really did uphold the influence, the interests of slavery all up through the end of the Civil War and sided with the South on Reconstruction and became part of the Solid South that was all involved in lynching. And I get the impression that Andrew Jackson and his version of the Democratic Party was most intent on removal of Indians. And oddly enough, that the Republican Party, up until very recently, has been the party identified with minorities. And I'm wondering what your commentator has to say about those things.
Jules Whitcomb?
That's all absolutely correct. Jefferson himself was a slaveholder, although he advocated, or at least said he advocated, the abolition of slavery. As we said earlier, the issue of race and slavery splintered the Democratic Party, tore it apart, and it took many years to put it back together again. Even such forward-looking presidents as FDR was very reluctant to recognize the interests of African Americans, and it was only the intercession of his wife Eleanor who finally brought Roosevelt around to taking some of the steps that were being requested by the African American community.
James, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And we find ourselves finally up to the era of recorded sound. So we're going to hear an illustration of what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was talking about.
I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people. This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms. Give me your help not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.
And Jules Witkover, is that where we begin to get a modern image of the Democratic Party, really?
Well, there were other Democratic candidates, such as Al Smith, who helped to identify the party with the little guy. But it really was Roosevelt's success in instituting a number of programs that we know now as the New Deal that did have tangible results in lifting up the fortunes of the little guy.
The construction of that New Deal coalition that seemed to put Democrats, seemed to establish Democrats as the ruling party of the United States for so long. Of course, the Republicans had been discredited by the disaster of the Depression. But illustrate what was the genius of the New Deal coalition?
Well, it was based on the idea of injustice and the need to bring together all elements of the society, whether they were black or white or Asian or whatever, and also economically in the working class, to bring them all together into what later became known as a black and blue, with blue being blue collar, coalition.
But the Roosevelt really changed the party in a lot of ways, but he managed to hold together a lot of disparate elements.
Well, yes. One of the reasons was that the growth of industrialization in the country and the flow of immigration gave the Democratic Party vehicles for winning the loyalty of a great many new Americans. And also with the conjunction of the growth of machine politics in the large cities, also tapped into that constituency and helped to make the Democratic Party the powerhouse that it became from the New Deal years on through perhaps the election of Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Let's get another caller in. Darryl's with us from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes. My comment's kind of, I don't think the Democratic Party today is the same even as it was when John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were in. I think that was a major turning point for the Democrats.
In what way?
I think they've gone more liberal and more for government control.
Even more than under Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Right.
And
Roosevelt warned us against the New Deal, that there was a lot of government.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the New Deal.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
But he also warned us against it, that it was, should be a temporary thing, if I haven't read my history book right.
Jules Witkover.
Well, I think the New Deal actually continued on and on, embraced not only by subsequent Democratic presidents, but if not embraced by Republican presidents such as Richard Nixon and Eisenhower, didn't make any serious effort to roll back the liberal programs of the New Deal. But what I think even went beyond what Roosevelt ever thought of, particularly in Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, was considerably more liberal than John Kennedy. And the party was moving in that direction until the really cataclysmic year of 1968, when the protests against the war in Vietnam and racial turmoil in the country enabled the Republicans to very effectively demonize liberalism, the New Deal, and that whole package. And in my opinion, at least, the Democratic Party has never really recovered from that.
Well, let's step back just a moment and remember what many would identify as a major turning point, and that would be the Civil Rights Act. Here's then-President Lyndon Baines Johnson.
It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
Lyndon Baines Johnson and Jules Witkover, that seemingly completes the transition from the party that was pro-slavery to the champion of civil rights.
Yes, it was, and it's managed to maintain that allegiance of the African American community to this day. Efforts to diminish that have really not been very successful, but the other elements of the Democratic Party have pulled away from the what I called earlier the black and blue coalition.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen under the intimidation, I would call it, of conservative Republicans demonizing the word liberalism. There has been a conscious effort by many Democrats, led most recently by Bill Clinton, to move the Democratic Party into the center, if not always actually in terms of programs, but in its perception.
And getting back to what you were talking about in 1968, the disruption at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, partly due to anti-war protests in no small part, but also based on the idea that the Democratic Party had to open up its processes and become more responsive to Democrats.
Yes, there was great dissatisfaction within the Democratic Party as a result of the chaos of 1968 and the feeling that average Democrats did not have enough say in the process of picking a presidential candidate. And as a result of that experience in 1972, there were changes made in how the Democrats proceeded, one of which produced what I'm out here in Iowa covering right now, is the caucus process, which together with primaries gave the average voter an opportunity, average Democratic voter or Republican voter, an opportunity to have much more say in the nomination of each party's candidate.
Let's go now to Nick, and he joins us from South Bend, Indiana.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
I'd like to ask your guest if he thinks that the National Democratic Party is splintering the Democratic Party, because it seems, especially now that the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of what the Republicans have done in the Texas legislature, and what I'm seeing in the 2004 presidential election.
And let me just say that Texas thing is the redistricting is what you're
right,
talking, congressional
right.
seats.
But the Republicans are gaining strength nationally, whereas the Democrats still have lots of local control because of that old falling out from the carrying over from your bosses in your cities, and lots of governorships, lots of state control, but the Republicans seem to be winning the battle on the national level. Well, does your guest think that the Democratic Party may split into two parties?
Jules Whitcomb?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we've had a history of attempts to create new parties. They've never been very, very successful. I think one reason, important reason, is that it would require a figure of tremendous stature. Of all the presidents we've had, say, in this century, I would say only somebody of the stature of General Eisenhower could possibly bring that off. But also, I think the structure, the way we now nominate and elect people, it works against a third party. It's very, very hard for a third party to raise the money that's required and to do the kind of organization that's required to have a party that can actually beat out the two major parties.
Do you think, though, that the Democrats are stronger on the state and local level and the Republicans currently are stronger at the national level?
Well, when you talk about governors, there are many more Republican governors than Democratic governors, so I think that would argue against that case. But I do agree that what we're seeing is now in the Democratic Party and in this contest for the presidential nomination is a serious split. You have some candidates who represent the left. You have some who represent perhaps just right of center, and some in the center. And I think the party is now struggling to establish for itself its own identification. The Republican Party, on the other hand, has moved almost entirely in terms of office holders and philosophy to the right, and therefore is much more unified at this stage than the Democrats.
Nick, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And an email we got from Gary Patterson in Wichita, Kansas. He writes, "The Democrats lost the South during the 1960s because the party became the party of secularism, not because of civil rights."
Well, I wouldn't share that opinion.
How would you balance those two?
Well, I think that the protests that we had in 1968 had a profound effect on voting patterns in the South. I think that, and also I feel that I think that as civil rights became more closely identified almost entirely with the Democratic Party, it hurt the Democratic Party in the South and led to the growth of the Republican Party, which originated really with Richard Nixon and has continued to grow.
Let's get another caller in and let's see if we can go to Michael. And Michael is with us from San Jose.
Yes, I was wondering if your guest might agree with the idea that the modern Democratic Party since World War II might really be best embodied in Hubert Humphrey, who was from Minnesota, where the Democratic Party is known as the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And he's the one who took on the Dixiecrats at the 1948 Democratic Convention and really gave the Democratic Party its focus for the next however many years as a result of that and several other socially conscious policies.
Well, I would agree that perhaps the party would be better off if it were seen in the image of Hubert Humphrey. But Humphrey was one of the chief targets of that effort of demonization of liberalism that I talked about earlier. And so I would doubt very strongly that whether Humphrey, if he were alive today and was running for president, would be in much of a position to get the nomination.
Thanks, Michael. And just a couple of minutes left, Jules Witkover, but I did want to ask you, you call the book Party of the People. You've talked about, you know, that decision to, you know, stand up for the little guy. Do you find that to be a consistent thread with the Democrats?
Yes, I do. I think there are matters of degree. Some presidents and some presidential candidates and other office holders in the Democratic Party are still as fervent for the basic ideas of social and economic justice as ever and as in the past. There are many who now have kind of walked away from that, but I think at the core, the Democratic Party does see itself and tries to present itself as the party of the people and of the little guy in defense of social and economic justice.
A quick email question from Lynn Allen. I have assumed that during the second half of a realignment of the Republican and Democratic parties is going to occur any year. First, the Republicans attracted the Southern Democratic conservatives in the late 80s and 90s with the help of Lee Atwater and Karl Rove. When are moderate Republicans going to recognize they really belong in the Democratic Party? I've thought that could be one of the outcomes of nominating General Clark, or is this just wishful thinking? You've got about 20 seconds to answer this, Jules.
I don't think that is going to happen going into the Democratic Party. I do think that sooner or later, moderate Republicans of the Nelson Rockefeller, Jacob Javits ilk will realize that their party has been hijacked by the other segment of the party, and will sooner or later try to create a new moderate Republicanism.
Jules Witkover, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jules Witkover is a political columnist for the Baltimore Sun, the author of Party of the People, the Democratic half of Random House's New History of the Political Parties. He joined us from WOI in Ames, Iowa, where he's covering the caucuses. More about them when we come back from a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.